Let's go ahead and get started. The Joint House and Senate Judiciary Committee hearing will come to order. Present today are House members Representative Grunberg and Representative Lynn. I know we'll be joined shortly by Chair Ramirez from the House. From the Senate Judiciary Committee is Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French, and we're glad to be joined today by Senator Johnny Ellis as well. The purpose of today's hearing is to get an overview of the therapeutic court program. The first presenter will be Michelle Bartley. She's the court program coordinator for the Alaska court system. Ms. Bartley, if you'd come forward, put yourself on the record, introduce the members of your team, and we'd be eager and happy to hear your presentation.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Bartley, and I'm the program coordinator for the therapeutic courts. With me today, at Janet's invitation, I am here, and Janet McCabe from Partners for Progress, Larry Cohn from the Judicial Council, and Doreen Schenkenberger, who is a graduate from one of our wellness courts in Anchorage. Also with us today, in support of the therapeutic courts, are other representatives from the court, Doug Woolover, and from the Trust, Steve Williams, and from NCAD, Matt Felix. My apologies if I've forgotten anyone. So, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak today with regards to our therapeutic courts. We're very proud of them. I'd like to refer to your packet. It's my understanding that on the agenda today, Judge Keith Levy was planning on speaking, but he was unexpectedly called out of town and so will not be presenting today. I have enclosed a very brief overview of the therapeutic courts within the state. One of them I inadvertently left off the handout, so I just want to kind of let you know that up front, and that is the Veterans Court in Anchorage. That court works with homeless veterans and does a lot of good work with the VA in Anchorage. So currently, statewide, we have 11 therapeutic courts in Alaska. Six have eligibility criteria that reflect DUIs or other alcohol-related charges. We have three of those in Anchorage, one in Bethel, one in Ketchikan, and one in Juneau. We have one felony drug court in Anchorage, a family court that deals with family issues, China cases in Anchorage, and two mental health courts, one in Anchorage and one in Palmer. We are currently in the planning process for four additional courts. In the community of Barrow, we have an FASD project. In Fairbanks, we have two courts that are in the planning process, a therapeutic court wellness court, which is a DUI / alcohol-related type court, and a juvenile mental health court. In Bethel, we are also planning an additional court, and that is a family court that will deal with China cases, families. Although these courts have differing eligibility criteria, substance abuse or substance dependency is a prevailing issue for these courts. However, through the collaborative efforts of the stakeholders, the therapeutic court participants receive treatment within a structured environment with a demonstrated measure of success. I'm not going to speak too much longer here. I'm going to defer next to Larry Cohn, who is the basketball coach, the executive director of the Judicial Council.
Thank you, Michelle. Any questions before Ms. Bartley leaves the table from members of the committee? Thanks so much. We'll turn it over to Mr. Cohn now. If you'd come forward, Mr. Cohn, put yourself on the record and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Larry Cohn. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, and I too want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm sure the members of the committee understand the Alaska Judicial Council is a separate state agency, one that's created in Alaska's Constitution. One of our major areas of responsibility as set out in the Constitution is to conduct studies to improve the administration of justice. And the framers recognized the importance of having an independent entity to conduct such studies without a vested interest to identify ways to improve our justice system. And while I'm delighted to be here with representatives of the court system and with Janet McCabe from Partners for Progress, I do want to stress that we are not part of the court system and we aren't advocates. We hope that you'll look to us as a source of information and data when you make your policy decisions on how best to improve the justice system. In 2001, when the legislature created the Anchorage Felony DUI Court and the Bethel Therapeutic Court in House Bill 172, you required that the courts be evaluated, and in particular, you required that the Judicial Council conduct the evaluations. The legislation required that the evaluations be completed by July of 2005. So we did an evaluation of those two courts, and we also evaluated the Anchorage Felony Drug Court at the same time. The problem that we had at that time was that the courts took a little bit longer to start up than anticipated, and so there really wasn't an adequate follow-up time to track the recidivism of the participants in these programs after they had completed the programs, whether they had graduated or been terminated from the program. So the focus of that evaluation was on how well participants in those programs refrained from recidivism while they were actually in the program. So we thought it was important to go back, now that we've had a sufficient amount of time, and look at how well the participants and graduates of those programs did to compare them to other offenders with similar problems who didn't participate in the therapeutic court program. And so that's what we did, and we published a report called Recidivism in Alaska's Felony Therapeutic Courts. We published it just a few weeks ago, and all the members of the committees should have a copy of that report. I brought some extra copies with me today, and all the legislators, in fact, should have a copy of that report. What we did is we compared the recidivism rates of 117 offenders who participated in these three felony-level therapeutic courts, and we compared them to recidivism rates for 97 matched offenders, comparison offenders, who we matched based on their age and their gender, their ethnicity, and importantly, their substance abuse and drug problems. They had similar problems to the people that were actually participating in the therapeutic courts.
Mr. Cohn, let me ask you one question just before we get into the details. Did you also control for criminal histories? That is, did you have, you know, folks who had one prior conviction compared to someone else with one prior conviction and so forth?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we did match on prior records. If anything, the prior records of the people who participated in the therapeutic courts were slightly worse than the comparison offenders. And that, in some ways, is to be expected because these programs are very, very rigorous. And unless there's a sufficient incentive for people to participate in these programs, and that incentive is frequently a long prison sentence, which is dictated by a bad prior criminal record, some offenders decide that they'd rather do the time. And so we matched as best as we could, but if anything, the prior records of the people who participated were slightly worse than the comparison offenders, which means that in the end, if those offenders that participated did better, they overcame even a worse criminal history than the comparison offenders had.
All the more reason to be happy with the results.
Exactly. We compared the participants to the comparison offenders. We also compared the recidivism rates of these participants to a baseline recidivism rate of felony offenders in Alaska generally. We issued a report last month, or in January, which was the first general study of recidivism in Alaska. And we looked at a couple of thousand offenders who had been charged with felonies and convicted of some offense. We followed them for 3 years. And we looked at how frequently they recidivated. We looked at what types of offenses they committed when they did recidivate and the factors that affected their recidivism. So we compared the therapeutic court participants to those offenders as well. We followed the therapeutic court participants for 1 year after they were finished with the program, and they either finished the program by graduating from it or by opting out of it or by being discharged from it. And we followed the comparison offenders also for 1 year from the time they completed their sentence. And we used data from the Alaska Department of Public Safety to look at the number of times that these offenders had been arrested and convicted during that 1 year period. We received, I should mention, funding for this evaluation from the Department of Health and Social Services. And I'd like to just briefly touch on the findings. I want to thank Cindy Smith, who I think passed out a handout which it tracks our executive summary in the report that identifies most of the findings that I'm going to mention briefly now. The findings were that the longer that participants stayed in the program, the less likely they were to recidivate, even if they didn't graduate. 54% of participants in these therapeutic courts graduated. And perhaps,
Mr. Cohen, let me just interrupt you to note the presence of Co-Chair Ramirez, and forgive us for starting without you, Chair Ramirez. We wanted to get the ball rolling.
Yes, sir.
Please, Mr. Cohen, continue.
Thanks. Probably the most useful, finding that we made is that 13% of the graduates were rearrested within a year after completing the therapeutic court program. And that compares to 32% rearrest rate within the first year for the comparison offenders. So the rearrest rate for the graduates was less than half the rearrest rate of the comparison offenders. And when we compared the rearrest rate for the graduates to our baseline recidivism rate for felony, our felony offenders that we studied, a couple thousand felony offenders that we studied, the results even more dramatic because 38% of those folks were rearrested within a year after being released from their incarceration. The combined groups of the graduates and participants, even those who didn't complete the program, had slightly lower recidivism rates than the comparison offenders, but the differences were not statistically significant.
Mr. Cohen, let me just interrupt you. I think one member of the committee has a question.
Yes, thank you for coming in here today. I noticed you're talking about people who did not graduate the program. Can you help us understand what happened to the people who didn't, why didn't they complete the program, and what happens to them if they did not complete the program?
Well, through the chair, Representative Lynn, there are a variety of reasons why people might not complete the program. They may voluntarily withdraw, decide that it's too hard for them. Or they may get discharged from the program because they're not complying with the requirements, the treatment. There are a lot of requirements. You have to be employed. And in that case, they wound up serving their sentences that they would have received had they not participated in the therapeutic program.
Thank you.
We found that older participants were less likely to be arrested than younger participants. Participants in the Anchorage Felony DUI Court were less likely to be arrested than those in the Anchorage Felony Drug Court and the Bethel Therapeutic Court. No participants who were reconvicted in the first year after they terminated their participation in the program were convicted of an offense which was more serious than what landed them there in the first place. None of the drug offenders who participated, whether they graduated or not, were convicted of any offense within the first year after their participation ended. And we found very interestingly that Native participants responded as well to the therapeutic programs as Caucasian participants. And we know that the Native community has been concerned with culturally relevant treatment programs, and we note in our general recidivism study that Native offenders tend to recidivate more frequently than other offenders of other ethnicities. So we think it's a significant finding that these therapeutic court programs have
benefited the Native community at least as well as other ethnicities. The council,
Mr. Cohn, I'm sorry, one more question.
And let me find it here. You said blacks and other ethnicities did not do as well. You said that the Native folks did well because of cultural factors. Why the discrepancy here with the blacks and other ethnicities, as you state here?
Representative Lynn, I don't know the answer to that, but we have recommended that we try and identify the reasons why the different ethnicities had relatively different success rates would be a useful thing to understand.
Thank you.
The bottom line on these courts is that the more often offenders graduate from them and the longer they stay in the program, the better they do. The less recidivism we observed. I want to stress that in our evaluation, we simply looked at the benefits of the therapeutic courts. We did not examine the costs, although we have recommended that there be a cost-benefit analysis done of these courts. I'll note that there are national studies that suggest that the courts have been very cost-effective. We are presently partnering in a four-year study of the Anchorage Wellness Court, which is a court that deals with misdemeanants with chronic alcohol problems. We're nearing the end of that study. We're partnering with the University of Alaska and the Urban Institute from Washington, D.C. That study will include a comprehensive cost-benefit analysis of the Anchorage Wellness Court, and we should publish that study in the fall, so you'll be getting copies of that at that time. I would be glad to answer any questions you have either now or later, and I brought extra copies of our reports if you need them, and if I can leave you with any a message. If there's any information that you don't see in any of our reports, whether it's therapeutic court report or our recidivism report or other studies we've done on the criminal justice system or the civil justice system, we have a lot of data, and we may be able to answer questions you have that you don't find in our reports, and I'd be glad to work with you if that should be the case. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I'm going to introduce Janet McCabe, our next speaker.
I have, Chair Emerson and I were conferring about the point you raised at the very end, the last bullet point, and that's the cost-benefit analysis. Is your organization equipped to perform that analysis? It's something you've called for, but I'm just wondering whether that's something that you and your group are able to undertake, or is that something that has to be done by perhaps a more sophisticated modeling and economically oriented group?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that the Judicial Council would be capable of providing useful information on that score. Cost-benefit analysis of therapeutic courts can tend to be somewhat imprecise, but certainly you can gather information that would be really useful, I would think. For example, there are benefits of therapeutic courts that are sometimes hard to quantify. You know, for every person that you avoid a child need of aid case, I mean, typically when cost-benefit analysis, people talk about cost-benefit analysis for therapeutic courts, they say, well, incarceration costs this, $50,000 a year, and treatment costs this, whatever it is, $15,000, $20,000 a year, and they leave it at that. But there's so many different costs that can be a consequence, as you know, of substance abuse and drug abuse that aren't in that more simple equation. I mean, if you can avoid a child in need of aid case, or which can last for 15, 18 years, or a fetal alcohol syndrome child, which the cost of that can be $1 million, there are if you include all of those factors into a cost-benefit analysis, then it's really a much more complete picture. But it's difficult sometimes to quantify those costs. But I think even more experienced or technical organizations would have difficulty with that. So I think the Judicial Council could provide useful information, provided that there's data out there that we can work with on that score.
And just I mean, do you have economists and accountants and folks like that on your staff?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have economists in account. We have a person who's our fiscal officer with an accounting background, but generally he's not involved in our research. But we don't have economists on our staff. What we do in our when we have analysis that's more sophisticated is we frequently contract that out to an academic organization, frequently a work group at the University of Alaska. We work with them. We take control of the work, but for the more sophisticated analysis, they typically do it. We also, when we do analysis, we generally have some type of peer review by running our studies by people who are considered to be experts in the field so that we know we're on the right path.
Sure. I'm sorry, Chair Ramirez.
Oh, no, it's
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out in our package there is a document that does have some of the details of the savings. And also, I attended the therapeutic court in Anchorage, and I remember getting another packet of information that seemed to have a little bit more detail than what we have in here on some of the cost savings. I was impressed with some of the studies that had been done and the overall cost savings that were in those documents, and perhaps you could forward those on to us at some point.
Through the chair, I would be happy to do that. I know that Janet McCabe has cited a study in Washington by a guy who ran the studies named Steve Aos or something like that. And that was a meta-analysis, meaning that it was a survey of hundreds of evaluations of therapeutic courts, and it included a lot of cost-benefit analysis. And I know this study is a very good one, and I know the bottom line in that study is that that the therapeutic programs have been very cost effective, and in identifying ways to better protect the public by spending money on therapeutic programs rather than enhanced incarceration, because after all, you know, unless you have life sentences for all these offenses, these people are going to get out of jail, and if they still have the problem that landed them in jail in the first place. And when we did our general study of recidivism, which I hope to present to the committees perhaps later this month, one of the things that we found, which is not really news but confirmed what we probably all know, is that the substance abuse problem, drug problem, is a major factor in affecting a recidivism of criminal offenders. So unless something, if there's something that can be done to address that circumstance, it probably goes a long way in terms of cost benefit, maybe further than incarceration, assuming that it's effective in protecting the public.
Thank you, Chair Ramirez.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cohen, it's really nice to see you again. I apologize for missing the first 15 minutes of your presentation. A couple of questions for you, and I was sitting here trying to think of a way to frame it and not sound terribly cynical. I saw a news story on the Prius, you know, the cars that have a super high mileage and they're environmentally friendly. And the nature of the story was that if you buy it because you want to feel better about the environment, then it's good to buy, but the energy savings that were actually associated with it, whether it was the cost or a denser construction, they were able to show statistically how it didn't save that much in consumption of energy over its lifetime, and that you were paying quite a considerable premium to enjoy what benefit it did derive. And I've, you know, ever since I read the book Freakonomics, I've questioned statistics because they're so easy to have them tell the story that you want them to tell. And so I wonder if you might give me your impressions. We had, because therapeutic courts are so, they're such a sexy product, and the court system doesn't have sexy products, that glamorous products that come along that often, because it's not in that nature of that branch of government, my own humble opinion as a person who's not an attorney. And so this one came along, and it enjoyed a lot of attention in my community, in Fairbanks, where I live. And so we had a meeting at our borough assembly chambers, and we brought in the local district attorney, Jeff Bryant, I think, and some of the judges in our community that were great advocates of therapeutic courts, Nisha Steinkruger and some of the other judges who I respect enormously. And frankly, as I was sitting there and assessing the cost and the benefit, I came away very unimpressed. I remember conferring with Representative Kelly, and I won't speak for him, but he and I, you know, had some murmurs, I think, or along the same lines, that you don't handle very many cases, that it takes an enormous amount of the capacity away from the Alaska court system to address a very narrow band of serial offenders, and then it has measurable and significant statistical results. My footnote is, if you believe the statistics, and I sometimes question those. And I came away thinking, well, just like the Prius, this is a great precursor to a better idea that we may not have come up with yet, and this might be the best idea, but it looks so time-intensive to me for a better benefit, but not an extraordinary benefit. And I know that I didn't put this before you in the form of a simple question, but if you could give me a similar response that's kind of a survey response and take a couple of minutes to kind of address the concerns I brought up, because I'm not that impressed with therapeutic courts. I am impressed with their outcome, but not with how much material you have to put into the sausage making machine to get a sausage link out on the back end. If you could speak to that broad array of concerns. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chairman.
Sure, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's perfectly appropriate to be skeptical of statistics. And I think the legislature, and I don't want to pat ourselves too much on the back, was smart or exercised good judgment in asking the Judicial Council to conduct this study. Because as I'm sure you know, you are cited with statistics all the time by people who are advocating for something. And in that situation, you know, you have reason to be somewhat cynical, I would think, about the statistics that you're hearing. Our role and the way we view our role is to provide information that's as accurate as we can. We don't have an agenda. These aren't Republican or Democrat data. We get our data from the Department of Public Safety and the court system and corrections. So we try and be as accurate as possible, and I would be here today reporting on the evaluation of these therapeutic courts even if the data were less favorable. You're absolutely correct that these are expensive propositions, and I think that sometimes it's easy to get caught up in the short-term costs when the payoff is down the road. And I think with therapeutic courts, a lot of the payoff is down the road by avoiding recidivism, by, as I mentioned before, some of the things I mentioned before, which can be extraordinarily expensive and aren't often calculated into the cost-benefit analysis in the short run of a therapeutic court. I know my wife, for example, works as a guardian ad litem. She's not a lawyer, but a guardian ad litem in children's cases, abused and neglected kids. And you know, you go in a child in need of aid case, which is frequently occasioned by an alcohol or drug problem, and you have a parents with a fetal alcohol syndrome kid, the state takes the child off the parents' hands, and you go in with seven or eight children after that, and these children are in state custody for years and years. And if you've ever been in a child in need of aid proceeding, There's an attorney for the mother, for the father, for the child, you know, so many different people. It's kind of like a therapeutic court. And, you know, if you can turn one person around that might be cranking out children in need of aid, it's almost incalculable the benefits that you derive from that. These therapeutic courts are very expensive, and I think it's very appropriate for the legislature to be interested in weighing the costs against the benefits. And hopefully, at least with respect to the wellness court in Anchorage, we will have very useful data for you next fall The Urban Institute is actually responsible for that aspect of our report next fall, and this is what they do. I mean, it should be, I hope, very useful information. But I don't know if I answered all your questions. But
It was very helpful. I appreciate your point of view. Thank you.
And it's a really useful exchange. I mean, I think you have to air these things out. So thank you for the exchange. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, I guess, it's always kind of interesting how two people can look at the same set of data or sets of data and come away with just two different views of how to interpret that data. And when I looked at the data that was provided to me several months ago, I was impressed. I look at the study in here that was done by the United States Government Accountability Office, which a nonpartisan group of United States Congress, which finds that those who have gone through drug courts have lower rearrest rates, lower conviction rates, fewer recidivism events, positive cost benefits for the drug court participants. And then when I look, I do think the cost benefit analysis is really critical. I mean, I absolutely, as public policymakers, that is something we need to look at. But the cost of prisons really can't be overlooked. And if we're keeping potentially hundreds of people, dozens of people out of jail, the cost in the document that was provided to us shows that the average prison construction cost for a bed is $135,000. That's not even including how much it costs to staff that prison. That's in the rail belt. In Bethel, it's $155,000. So I do think there are a lot of costs that are involved in. But it is something that we need to look at, the cost-benefit analysis, for sure. Thank you.
Thank you. And just for the committee's information, I think Ms. McCabe is going to talk to us about more about cost-benefit analysis when it's her turn to speak. Other questions from the members of the committee for Mr. Cohn? Hearing and seeing none, thank you very much for your presentation. It's a pleasure to have you here this afternoon.
Thank you very much. I would like to introduce Janet McCabe. In 1999, Janet McCabe and Judge Jim Wanamaker, who's an Anchorage District Court judge, worked together to establish the Alaska's first therapeutic court for addicted offenders. That was the Anchorage Wellness Court for misdemeanor offenders, municipal misdemeanor offenders in Anchorage. Since then, she and her nonprofit organization, Partners for Progress, have secured a number of Department of Justice grants for therapeutic courts in Alaska, and they have supported the growth and development of these courts in different locations. So, Janet McCabe.
Ms. McCabe, welcome. Welcome to the Joint House and Senate Judiciary Committee. Please put yourself on the record, and we're delighted to have you with us this afternoon.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chairman French and Chairman Ramos, members of the State and House Judiciary Committee, and guests. For the record, I am Janet McCabe, speaking for Partners for Progress. We are a nonprofit organization that works solely to support the therapeutic courts, as Larry Cohen just explained. I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak today, and especially to thank you and your legislative colleagues for all you have done in the past 6 years for therapeutic justice in Alaska. You took a major step in 2001 with House Bill 172 and set up the pilot felony therapeutic courts in Bethel and Anchorage. And Larry Cohen has just given you the results of that wise decision. Is truly in a number of lives, probably lives saved, and probably fetal alcohol syndrome people, babies avoided. It is impressive. In the intervening years, you as the legislature established provisions that created important incentives to encourage people to opt into the Judge Wanamaker's especially tough wellness court for alcoholic misdemeanors. And last year you added to this legacy by passing House Bill 441, and that put the Bethel and Anchorage courts on in codified law, gave them ongoing status. You established a consistent statewide sentencing system for all the courts statewide, and put those courts on the regular operating budget. We put House Bill 441 in the packet because It is a very important milestone that was in therapeutic justice. Well, my assignment was to tell you about costs and benefits, and I'm afraid I don't have the, the totally financial discipline study that is coming out, but I'm not so sure that the finance is the key thing. I think it has a lot, there's a lot of interweaving between the finance and the human benefits. And so there are really two ways of evaluating costs and benefits, and both are very legitimate, the social and the budgetary. And the first of these views is in terms of public protection and reduction of harm, and the second looks at public expenditure. And I'll give you a few examples from to illustrate how Alaska's therapeutic courts perform under each form of evaluation. From the social point of view, most benefits are in things that do not happen. Drunk driving that does not occur, that's a big thing because many of the people in the therapeutic courts are drunk drivers. Property that is not destroyed, people not killed or injured, families that are not stressed or broken. The opening sentence in the Alaska Judicial Council report sums it up very well. Graduates of the three courts were rearrested and reconvicted far less frequently than comparison offenders. And by now, the data from Alaska and from national sources, and I'll refer you to a very good, well, Larry mentioned it, perhaps the best national source. These data leave no doubt that therapeutic courts are a powerful method of reducing repeat crime. The biggest public benefit of harm reduction is for individual people and for society, but there is, as I say, also a cost dimension to the human dimension. Just as an example, the Anchorage Wellness Court graduated a young woman recently who had a baby, conceived the baby, and the baby was born while the woman was in the program. And she had a dreadful record of prior alcoholism, but the baby was not affected by fetal alcohol syndrome. Another young woman who's also pregnant has been in the program for 10 months and is staying drug and alcohol free, protecting her child from harm. And these mothers and their children will have vastly different futures because of the therapeutic court. The savings of public money by preventing just two cases of fetal alcohol syndrome, it probably paid for the upfront costs of the courts. I've heard different estimates. Larry gave you $1 million over the course of the life of a child with fetal alcohol syndrome. Recently, I heard a doctor say it was $2 million, but it doesn't, the amount is not significant, it's enormous. The second form of evaluation measures cost efficiency and asks, is the program designed to maximize return on dollars? In answer, the therapeutic courts really are very carefully focused so that resources are placed where there is the most potential for future public benefit. To give you an example, would you look please at page 3 in the packet on the right-hand side? This is a cross-section of the Anchorage Wellness Court participants last month. And you will see that the addiction courts are highly selective. They focus on what some people call churners. They're people who have a pattern of multiple addiction-based offense, people who can become responsible, productive members of society if they are given the treatment plus that the wellness court offers. Violent offenders and sex offenders are not included, nor does the court generally admit first-time DWI offenders. People on the first DWI end of the crime spectrum usually self-correct. And only a small fraction of first DWI offenders go on to commit a second DWI. So why spend the resources of the court on them? Instead, the wellness court focuses on individuals who are really trapped in the revolving door and who are so addicted that they repeatedly do illegal and destructive things while under the influence, sometimes at great harm to themselves and to others. And just as a footnote, you know, the threat of repeated jail doesn't reach the people that are so addicted. They, you know, the addiction affects their judgment, and they don't stop to think before they get in the car and perhaps go out and kill somebody. Without treatment plus in a therapeutic court, the repeat addicted offenders would probably serve another term in prison after they are out for a while, and about 60% of those with more than one DWI conviction, that's the repeaters, are rearrested for another driving offense within 3 years of release from custody. It is really very aptly described as a revolving door. The court may order these people to treatment programs, but only half ever show up for the regular treatment programs for the first appointment. And retention is very low. And I'd also like to add that, you know, we've seen people come into the therapeutic court with an ASAP file about a foot high. They've gone into the program, they've gotten out, they've been sentenced again, they've gotten out. And that, by golly, is very expensive. Instead of treatment plus, in a therapeutic court provides a whole packet of addiction fighting tools, and they combining first and foremost the coercive power of the court to keep them there for 18 months. They also get cognitive behavioral treatment, medicine that blocks the craving, safe and sober housing initially, AA meetings, mandatory employment, and employment assistance, and much more. And this tough integrated program provides the ingredients for a positive response with a severely addicted population. It is very hard work for both the participant and for the team of people involved, but the rewards in lives changed, harm avoided, families reunited, basically is in seeing people become responsible, law-abiding members of the community. That's the reward. Partners also looked at national data on therapeutic courts to give you information on costs and benefits. And the best overall review that we found was a study that was funded by the Washington State Legislature. And at the legislature's direction, the Washington State Institute for Public Policy looked nationwide and picked out 571 evaluations that were evidence-based and had sound comparison groups that were basically very credible studies. They summed it all up. So in a sense, a lot of our homework was done for us. And among the findings, just the key thing is, it was a well-documented conclusion that adult drug courts and treatment, as well as cognitive behavioral therapy for drug and alcohol abusers in prison or community, reduce crime and save taxpayers money and crime victims money. And I want to conclude
Ms. McCabe, before you conclude, I think there may be a question or two for you. I know Chair Amherst has a question.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and take those now.
Fine.
Yes, ma'am. Karen, go back and tell your boss this, because Representative Coghill taught me how to ask questions.
Okay.
I'm new to government. The first question I'm going to ask you rhetorically, but why is it that the Department of Corrections has become the new institution where we put our mentally ill people? Because we've had overviews from the correction system, and we find out now that hospitals don't hold people that have disorders. It's our correction system that does. That's the rhetorical part of my question. The question that I have is these results sound terrific, but you could substitute in the word judge for some other entity that would be overseeing all of these dynamics. You just went through a roster, and I wish I would have written them down.
I'll give you a copy.
Yeah, yes, ma'am. It was about 7 or 8 steps that were involved just a couple of moments ago. And I don't understand why we are using a judge to administrate that program when it doesn't sound like it fits into the conventional definition of what a judge does. And I'm wondering why we can't move this to a more of an administrative capacity or somebody who's in social services to oversee all of these elements that would have a judge standing behind them. I appreciate the savings from fetal alcohol syndrome and all of these things, but in the meantime, people can't get access to the court system because the court system is so overwhelmed with the volume of work that they have. Why can't this be administrated or have an administrator who's not necessarily, you know, one of only 6 judges that we have in the interior, for instance? We just added a superior court judge, and with the therapeutic court program we want to incorporate into Fairbanks, it would take almost a judge's exclusive availability on the bench. We wouldn't have broadened the access to justice for people in my community because of how time intensive it is with a judge. Why does a judge have to administer the implementation of a therapeutic court?
Well, that's a reasonable question. They are people that have committed a crime and are in the court system. Certainly the coercive power is from the judge. I think there's been some talk that a magistrate might be able to work that way, but you've got to have the force of the judge. I mean, that's the key to making this work, because somebody, if they do well, the judge in the black robe with his authority compliments them. And for many people, this is perhaps one of the first times they've heard somebody in an authority position say something good. That makes a big difference. But the perhaps the bigger thing is he has the authority to put them back in jail quickly for a day or two. You need an individual with the authority of the judge.
Ma'am, with all due respect, I'm not looking for serial DUI offenders to get compliments from a judge when it means that many other citizens in our community that are victims of a broad array of crimes, from property crimes to violent crimes to sex offender crimes, are not having access to justice as victims because we've got judges that are complimenting serial DUI offenders for staying sober insofar as the court can keep track of it. And I'm just seriously troubled by that whole broader notion. Nobody doubts the authority of the courts, but I need a better reason than having some authority figure in a robe compliment a serial DUI offender. Yes, ma'am. I know I wanted to jump in myself. So I need a better reason than that to feel warm and fuzzy toward a very cost-intensive program like therapeutic courts. Can you offer me a better rationale or a stronger rationale for why we want to tie up the judge's time doing this as opposed to another authority figure? And you said a magistrate, but I actually was thinking less than that. We don't hesitate when it comes to the DMV to having administrative revocations of driver's licenses, and we've inquired what the pay grade is of people that are doing administrative revocations of licenses, and it's not a remarkable pay grade. Why does it require a remarkable person to administer this program?
Well, Chairman Ramos, I think the answer that would be best to your point is that the therapeutic courts are designed to take people that are seen in the current situation, that are seen repeatedly over and over and over and over again, and tie up the judge, tie up the whole court system, perhaps take resources that they could otherwise have put on your more serious, the sex offenders and the murderers, that, you know, in the long run, this approach reduces the time that the judge should have to spend on, and I won't say they're minor offenders, the people that, if you put them back out in the community, and inevitably they will be out in the community, have plenty of, are very likely to cause a serious accident, take somebody's life. You know, they're serious offenders in terms of their potential for harm.
Thank you.
Can I complete?
Absolutely, please.
Okay. Okay, well, to conclude, I'd like to suggest a couple of action items for your consideration. Partners for Progress, our organization, urges you to continue your support of the therapeutic courts for addicted offenders by maintaining the existing operation budgets for Bethel and Anchorage therapeutic courts, and of course for the mental health courts in Palmer and Anchorage. But in addition, we suggest that you lay some of the groundwork for comprehensive planning at all the to put all the existing and new therapeutic courts on a sustainable basis. And as part of that, we should look at ways to increase the efficiency, to reduce the cost, to use people that are less costly. You know, one of the fine-tuning that has emerged through this process is that for these status hearings, instead of having the defense and the prosecutor show up all the time, unless there's a real problem, they don't show up. You know, there are changes like that that are being developed over time to really make the program more efficient. The other big efficiency that is needed, is occurring, is in the growth of volume. You know, the more intense, the more volume there is in the therapeutic courts, the quicker people are able to do things, perhaps the less clapping we do, but I do think that's valuable to changing people. But and we're pretty snappy about sending people back to jail if they offend, and it is quick and systematized now. But anyway, there are efficiencies in volume that can be realized. So we've given the chairman of the two judiciary committees, and I believe we delivered one to you, Chairman Ramres, and also to Chairman French, suggested draft resolution that would ask the seven state and nonprofit entities involved in therapeutic courts to collaborate and develop a proposal to the legislature for a cost-effective system of funding and supporting the therapeutic courts on an ongoing basis. You know, currently the courts are funded in part, good part, by grants. And there is a need to continue. The grants will eventually run out. So, and secondly, we recommend that you look at the state of Washington study. I included, you might look at page 10 that has some good examples of what this very rigorous analysis proposed as being cost effective.
On page 10, just for folks who may be watching at home, I see a chart that is arranged in landscape portrait that right. says options to reduce crime by adult felony offenders, what works, and benefits and costs. Is mm-hmm. that the one?
That's right. Yeah, and it has a couple That's please, correct, Chairman.
Please proceed.
Pardon?
Yes, please proceed.
Okay.
I just want to make sure everybody was on the same page.
All right. Okay, the savings and benefits can be very large, depending on the program that you choose. Some are not cost effective. This same larger study points out how difficult it is to find cost-effective approaches to sex offenders. Treatment there is highly expensive. Anyway, there are some that are terrific. So you might look at that program, and then you might even consider for the short run adopting some of the programs that are very cost effective under this study and looking at their potentiality in Alaska. So that concludes my remarks, but I'd like to have you hear directly from a person who really knows the benefits of therapeutic courts, Doreen Schenkenberger.
Ms. McKay, maybe before we begin,
okay.
Ms. Schenkenberger, I think Chair Emerson has one more question for you, and then we'll turn it over to your last presenter.
All right, fine.
I do. And Janet, you're doing a great presentation, so I don't want you to take my probing.
No, I appreciate questions.
The question I would like to pose to you, and then if Larry could come up and assist maybe through Judicial Council, is I think that the therapeutic courts are exceptional as a precursor to something that may work better. I have a friend of mine who just went through radiation treatment, and it's the best program that's out there right now for eradicating cancer out of the body, but there's little doubt that 50 years from now we're going to look back and say, my God, that was barbaric what we were doing to people's bodies to mm-hmm. get them well. And I look at the therapeutic court system and I think, well, it certainly is a path to wellness, but efficiency is not one of the hallmarks that I would use to describe the program. So I wonder between you and Larry if we might task you to give us a sense or to see what Judicial Council could do in not only trying to generate the statistical merit of the therapeutic court system, but give us an indication over the next 3, 5, 7, 10 years what the therapeutic court program may evolve into, because surely it can't stay as labor intensive as it is now with such a rare commodity as the judges who are on this. And so I'd like to see what your sense is of what the therapeutic court program is going to evolve into. And I don't mean 6 months from now if you get an adequate amount of funding for 2008. What might the program look like in the year 2015 or 2018 in that regard, please?
Future forecasts, please.
Well, of course, I don't have a real forecast, but you can look at some of the other states that have had strong therapeutic courts going for quite a while. And for example, in Georgia and Oregon, there are therapeutic courts that handle as many as 1,000 people, individuals in a year. And they have fine-tuned their system so the judge sees a whole group of people just for an instant or two, but establishes some kind of rapport so that I've heard the judge in Georgia talk about, one of the really key things, is an individual seeing that the judge is concerned that they recover, that they do better. That makes a difference. And it doesn't take very long, but it needs to be there as an ingredient, and they need to, reappear. But the therapeutic courts could become much more a part of the court system, could, in being larger, be more cost-effective, and could truly reduce the amount of time that the court needs to spend on these repeated offenders and free up the court to deal with other problems.
Mr. Chair, I think I hope that in the near future we will have some answers to this question or have a better perspective on it through our study, this multi-year study of the wellness court in Anchorage.
Our particular component in that study is to study the transferability of wellness court policies and practices to other therapeutic courts. And the process that we've gone through to do that is to interview about 150 different people, and I even think some members of this committee were probably interviewed by our staff person, about what's working from their perspective, what's not working, what impediments have they run into, all kinds of things. These are people that we know have supported therapeutic courts and people that we know have not been supportive of therapeutic courts. And so I think when we publish our report, which is funded by the National Institute of Justice, our component in particular should be able to answer questions about efficiency. How can we do this better and quicker and cheaper? And where is this going to work? And where is it going to not work? And where should we dedicate our resources, or what priorities should we have? So I think while I can't sit here and tell you what it's going to look like, the interviews that we've done with 150 people, policymakers, stakeholders, participants, legislators, should paint a better picture. That combined with the fact that we're doing a comprehensive literature review on therapeutic courts. So we'll know more than I can tell you now. But I would like to respond a little bit to the question that you asked, Ms. McCabe, because I've asked that question myself. You know, a judge gets, after last session, paid even more money than before. It's expensive to have the judge do this. And why wouldn't this work? Couldn't you put a black robe on the court clerk and achieve the same results? I don't know. You know, but the fact is that question has occurred to other people as well. And I can't tell you why it seems to matter that it's a judge doing it, but other people nationally that have looked at that have seemed to conclude that it does make a difference. I don't know the answer to that, but certainly if there's a cheaper and better way of doing it, that would be a good thing to know.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I may. Well, you know, look at the protocol around this table. If we were sitting at plastic folding tables and we were in jeans and t-shirts, would, you know, this hearing enjoy the gravity that it enjoys, you know, by having therapeutic courts? But the benefit of having the both bodies of the legislature here to talk about this program outweighs the merit of being in jeans and t-shirts versus suits and ties. What caught me is your reference to better, quicker, cheaper. To some degree, this is widgets. You know, there are not names on the handout that we have here on pages 3 and 4. And just for the camera to follow the chairman, this is just a roster of males and females, various ages, and current offenses. These aren't names. These might as well be widgets, even though when they go before the judge, they are a person with feelings, with issues, with problems, with substance abuse issues. But I'm impressed that a court system in another state can roll through 1,000 folks in their therapeutic court system. And the number that we heard in Fairbanks, and I don't remember what time frame it was relative to, but it was like 20. You know, we just picked up another Superior Court judgeship in Fairbanks. We need it. And we don't need it because we want to address therapeutic courts. That seems to be an interest of the judges are the greatest advocates in our community of the therapeutic court system. I'm interested in a judge who can take on, 15 or 17% of the broader workload. Or, you know, in our community, we don't have a judge on the bench that's got an expertise in family law. You know, I hope that when we fill that position, that we do it with somebody who has a great knowledge in that particular area. How do we get our volume up? What kind of information, when you come back to us next year, and I'm delighted to hear that, Mr. Chairman, and I hope we repeat this hearing next year to get an update on how we're doing, how can we get our volume up statistically? The state of Alaska year over year and the state of Alaska in comparison to other states that have a similar capacity, and what kind of productivity gains do they show? Because it's wonderful to move away from Ms. McCabe's point of view, which is having somebody in a robe pay a serial DUI offender a compliment, to hearing somebody in the Judicial Council say, we can do this better, quicker, cheaper. If we can find an answer that's somewhere in between those two data points, then I'm going to feel much better about helping to support a program like this.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, ma'am.
Or Mr. Co-Chairs? Your scope should not be just on the court system. This is a revolving door that takes people, you know, if they don't, they are in the court system, they go to jail, they get out, they reoffend, they go back to the court system, then they go back to jail, and sometimes they kill or hurt somebody in the process. There is a lot of opportunity for introducing therapeutic programs in prison or as people are getting out of prison, and that's another really good way to address this problem. What I think needs to be focused on is not, well, of course, therapeutic courts, but really how to intervene to stop repeat addicted offense. And that's why I, just to complete, that is why I wanted you to see that study that was done by the state of Washington, because that does have a couple of straightforward, very good ideas. In fact, the one that has most cost effective was co-created by the person that does some of the training for the cognitive behavioral therapy groups for the wellness court. And it would be not all that complex to tell the Department of Corrections about it.
Good points all, thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I can think, just a couple of things that could possibly increase participation in these programs just off the top of my head. And again, I think our report will identify this in a more informed way. But one of the things that might affect participation is the availability of treatment. In some communities, there just are not effective treatment options. And so there isn't a high participation rate because it doesn't lead anywhere. I also think that it would be a good idea to look at the programs in terms of the incentives, what incentives there are to participate in these programs. When we have difficulty, when there is difficulty encouraging offenders who were just accused of misdemeanors from participating in therapeutic courts, it's because they're measuring the regimen of the therapeutic program, which extends in often cases over 18 months, against a relatively short prison term. And perhaps there is some modality, some treatment regimen that could be, if not as effective, still effective, where it's not as protracted, not as demanding, and the trade-off being that more people would be willing to opt into the therapeutic program. I don't know the subject matter well enough to preach about that, but that is one thing I would want to look at if I were trying to answer that question.
Thank you.
Thank you both. You have one more witness for us.
Okay. Well, now I'm really happy to introduce Doreen Schenkenberger. And Doreen is graduated from the Anchorage Wellness Court under Judge Wanamaker in April 2005. And like many other graduates, she is very appreciative of what the state and the program has given to her and wants to give back by telling you about it, about her experience.
Ms. Schenkenberger, if you'd come forward and have a seat here at the table, just state your name for the record. We'd be most happy to hear what you have to say to us this afternoon.
Thank you, Doreen Schenkenberger. Wellness Court graduate from Anchorage. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senate and House members and guests. It's truly an honor to speak here today before you. In fact, it's nothing less than a miracle I'm even sitting here before you today. If it were not for the wellness court, I truly believe I would not be here. Having been a practicing alcoholic, as I was for many, many years of my life, I could only be sure of three things. I would either be committed, incarcerated, or I would end up killing someone or die someday. 4 years ago, that's exactly what I was looking at after yet another DWI. And I'm actually lucky to be alive. But I knew it was the end. I knew something had to happen. I was going to have to send my children out of state to live with relatives, move somebody into my house, and I was going to go to jail for quite a long time. And then from Janet and other people in the court system, I learned about the wellness court program. And I knew that I needed something very drastic. I had a 10 years of sobriety in the past after completing a 60-day inpatient program with the Clitheroe Center, but my drinking had escalated to the point where I needed serious intervention, and I knew I had to do this. My jail time was actually going to be shorter than this program would have been, but to keep my children and to get well, I knew I had to do this, so I asked for it. And it's because of this program, the length of it, the stringent rules and the guidelines, the people involved, and the ongoing support, such as Partners for Progress and all the people that are involved with this program, I'm still sober today, 4 years later. There was a time in my life that I was absolutely ashamed of being an Alaska Native woman, because since I was very young, I always equated that with being a drunk Alaska Native woman. I'm not ashamed today. I'm not ashamed anymore. And in fact, for the first time in my life, I know who I am, and I'm proud of who I am. And that's a powerful tool in my sobriety today. Today, my sobriety has positive rippling effects on all around me. Because of my sobriety, one of my family members and three other friends have quit drinking. Today I have a new life, and I help and support others in sobriety. I take care of my kids, and I'm at school with them all the time. I volunteered for my community council and at the Awake Shelter in Anchorage. I write grants for alcohol and juvenile justice programs for Alaska Native tribes. I also work in the tourism industry that brings dollars into the state. But besides all of these things that I'm allowed to do today because I'm sober, because I got help, I feel the greatest benefit and the greatest impact is within me and how I feel about myself today. And it's how my kids look at me today. It's the role model that I am for them today because I quit drinking and I quit smoking. And I'll end with this story that I told when I graduated in 2005. When I started the Wellness Court program, my daughter came home with her math assessment, and she got 3 out of 50 correct. So she got 47 problems wrong on her math assessment. After 8 months in this program, she came home with her final math assessment, and she only missed 3 out of 50. And those are real things. My son was so sick from my drinking. He hated school, and he would bite his nails until they were bleeding. He doesn't do that anymore, and he loves school. Because of the Wellness Court program, we have a life that's unequal today to anything. And I don't know how you put a value on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schenkenberger. Okay. Questions from members of the committee? Chair Ramirez.
Thank you. It's a very inspiring story, and you are remarkably articulate, and I thank you for coming before us. May I ask you a question? Because you do write grants now for, you said for rural and for juvenile justice and alcohol-related programs, unlike on infomercial late at night, you would be one of the people that would be profiled in the infomercial. You would, you're clearly you're a spectacular person who has, you know, discovered, you know, the good that you know, as you say, was dormant inside of you, and you're really blossoming. And you're, and I hope that you go around and talk to some of the members in this building, because you have you continue to do counseling, and you're close to other programs. Do you think that your success that you've enjoyed through the Wellness Court program is typical of the program, or are you in the top, you know, 5% of the people that graduate out of the wellness program, or do you feel that you're in the middle? Do you think that the system generates, dozens or hundreds of success stories that would equate to yours, or do you think that you're in the top 5%? You kind of appreciate the question that I'm asking.
I can appreciate that, and I probably would have to say I'm probably in the top somewhere. I am extremely lucky to have had a support system around me, and to have kept that in place through community organizations. But the community of Anchorage has it to give to you if you want it. I think that there is huge potential for future success the more, honestly, people like me you help. And I can stay sober. Just from my sobriety alone, I've affected so many people around me. People have quit drinking around me. I've quit smoking. My children are doing great. And it just keeps on getting better and better. I think a lot of the success depends on more people who are motivated, like myself, to be involved in the program and in our communities.
Thank you. You are extraordinary, and you should continue being a public speaker and to affect the lives of others. You're very compelling at a table, and you tell a marvelous story, and I just applaud your efforts to enjoy some self-reliance and to improve the lives of others around you in your community and your family, and you tell an amazing story, so I thank you.
Thank you, I'm very grateful.
I think Chair Emmer spoke for the rest of us, and I appreciate you being here as well. I should point out that Representative Guttenberg joined us for a good portion of this meeting. We've also been joined by the senior staff from many members of the legislature that could not be here. Before we wrap up, I just want to say thank you again to Ms. Bartley for being here, Ms. McCabe, Mr. Cohn, and Ms. Schenkenberger. Thank you all for making a strong presentation this afternoon. With that, this joint committee is adjourned.